This is a Women Uninterrupted podcast, the space where we host difficult conversations between different generations of women. Brought to you by The Hindu. Hello, I'm co-host Anna Thomas on Women Uninterrupted, and with me I have Dr. Lakshmi Menon, a pediatrician and a neonatologist with 23 years of experience. Welcome, Dr. Lakshmi.
Thank you. Thank you, Anna.
In this episode of Women Uninterrupted, we are talking about the first 2 years of life for both mother and baby. So I've invited Soumya Shukla, who has a 14-month-old and has left her behind with her family, to join us today. So thank you for coming, Soumya, and welcome. I'm sure you have a lot of questions, but can I begin by asking Dr. Lakshmi, have there been any significant changes from the time you started your career and now in approaches to baby care, for instance, to breastfeeding and weaning, the length of time? Are we all wiser now than then?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Anna. I was just struck by that thought when you were saying it. I remember when I graduated, or when I finished my MD, this was mostly the late 90s that I finished my MD, and I graduated, I became a MD pediatrics in 2000. So you can literally imagine the turn of the century, I was a full-fledged professional doctor ready to go. So now the difference is that, so I've seen across 23 years of my practice, the change in parenting style, the change in the way that we look at children overall, considered from before when, you know, the concept was they are best to be seen and not heard. And now we have graduated to the time that your voice counts too. So there is that distinct shift that has come. Plus, this entire thing about children grow up by themselves, that concept is gone. We invest a whole lot more into their mental progress, mental health. And there is a significant difference in the way that we look at nutrition. So from where we wanted these nice, chubby-looking babies to children who are maintaining their centiles and more milestone-centric approach, making sure their development is fine versus how they look physically. So you're allowing for all kinds of leeways to happen now. And I think it's a very good start. And I just hope we keep evolving with time. And I'm happy to be a part of that journey as well.
Yeah. As well as the emphasis on maternal mental health.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. So for sure. I mean, that's been very, very disregarded in the past. And everybody used to say to these new mothers to just, you know, bear it and get on with it. Now there is a lot more empathy and sympathy and trying to understand where are the issues or where's the angst coming from. So yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, Soumya. You and I, we're like, I think, 27 years apart.
Right.
Sleep training. I think that's a burning issue for you.
Yeah, definitely. My daughter doesn't sleep for more than 2 hours, even now at 14 months. Huh. So that's definitely something I would love to probably have a good night's sleep, maybe longer than 2 hours. Entire concept of sleep is a very protective mode of your human body. That is when your body heals, repairs itself, and new connections are formed, especially in the brain. So this is very, very important for the baby. So when we are talking about a sleep number of hours and things like that, it varies anywhere from 12 to 16 hours to 8 to 10 hours as the child keeps growing. Understanding that it's a range. It's not that, okay, my child has, this is only 15 hours today and where is the 1 hour that I have lost? Why is the child? And that's not important. What is important is that the child needs to be rested, playful, attaining the milestones what the baby has to, and the child should be physically growing on the chart the way that we want them to in terms of the centile curves. So it's not about the number of hours that the baby sleeps, it's also the quality of sleep that the baby sleeps. Second, that understanding that as they grow, as from infants to toddlers to child, you will find that they are getting more and more receptive to the environment around them. So it's very important to understand that and allow so a child who sleeps, used to sleep at 2 hours mid-morning and 2 hours mid-afternoon, and then used to sleep for a solid 8-10 hours in the night, is not the same child in 1 year. Now he must have lost his mid-morning nap and may have a max of half an hour nap in the afternoon and prefers to sleep the bulk of his sleep only at night, which is also fine. So what we need to understand is the sleep training thing is mostly about trying to cater to the normal family routine. So we need to tailor the baby's sleep so that it suits your needs. So for example, if you're a working mom from 8 o'clock to 5 o'clock in the daytime and the better part of the day is the baby is going to sleep, you will have a fresh, lovely baby when you are bone tired and come back ready to just rev and go. And that's not what you want. So you need to be a little bit smarter and perhaps a little wiser about this and try to sort of regulate the sleep pattern a little early on in life. And it's very easy to do that. When they are smaller babies, all you need to take care of is the audiovisual ambience around them. So it's a baby of 3 month baby or a 2 month baby. You can start by having a little bit more brighter environment in the daytime so the day-night circadian rhythms kicks in. Mm-hmm. So you have a quieter night and you have a, you know, the lights are dimmer, everybody talks in hushed tones. There's not a lot of fuss about diaper changing and all of that. It's done more seamlessly in the night, whereas in the daytime you can afford to play with the baby a bit more. So now the baby gets a sense of the day-night and that sort of translates into better sleep as the baby progresses. So it's easier said than done, I know, but it's mostly a lot about discipline. So it works for us when the baby sleeps in the daytime because you can get your work done. But unfortunately, that bites you in late at night. So therefore, you need to balance this approach out and see what works for you. So, I mean, there's no set formula, but you can believe me when I say that the baby will catch how much the sleep they want. So there is no such, it just doesn't suit us. That's why you keep worrying that, oh, my baby is not sleeping enough. The baby is slept enough. The baby slept all enough that in the daytime. So all we need to be is a little smarter about this and sort of, you know, flim it. That's all. So, yeah, so I'm not sure how helpful that is.
Well, that's great that he's absolutely it. Well, by the line from that, I understood that you kind of give it away. The bedroom environment, the quiet.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And then give it, they give that, that's what
right.
You said, yeah?
Right.
That's what
right.
I said. How about sharing a bed?
So, sharing a bed is a very controversial concept. So we went from sharing a bed being absolutely fine to not allowing the baby to co-sleep. Now we are back to babies to be okay to co-sleep. So what I have understood in my 23 years is that babies who co-sleep or babies who don't co-sleep, there is no difference in the way that they sleep. The only thing is that if you are the kind who are a light sleeper and if you are tossing and turning a lot, or let's say that you have a partner who comes in and goes out in the night because of certain work timings or certain calls or whatever, those kind of disturbances you don't need. So if that is going to be a reality for you, then perhaps the baby needs a crib of its own. But if that's not the case, and you know, once everybody hits the bed, you're in the bed and that's it, then it's fine for the baby to co-sleep. The third thing I also wanted to say is that the angle of co-sleeping and whether the baby is safer in the crib than on the bed, there is no, like I said, there is no yes or no about it. If the baby is comfortable in the crib environment, and that has been happening right from the word go, like right from when the baby was an infant, you've started that happening, then it is possible for the baby to sort of keep thriving in that environment. But one fine day you wake up, a baby who was co-sleeping is put in the crib, there is a lot of difficulty in that detaching from the parental arm or the parental patch right away. And that becomes a little bit challenging to do. It's not that it's undoable, but there's a whole lot of crying and trauma and all of that, which will take a while for you to, unless you're very strong, it takes a while to settle. But if you're okay with the baby sleeping with you from the word go, then let the baby sleep like that for at least 3 to 4 years of their life. So after the third year, they understand the concept of me, myself, my place, my toy, my... So that's when you can encourage the concept of having their own space, having their own bed, having their own, you know. And then there's an entire thing that I encourage parents to do, that ask the child for permission. Can I come in here? Can I sit here? Is this okay if I play with you? All that. So it helps the child to say, I also can make the rules. I also can sort of, you know. So there is a lot of clues that your baby gives you. sometimes there are children who don't want to play with the parent. They're very happy doing something on their own. The parent comes right next to them and they want to play and they shove the parent away. It's very possible. There are times where I've seen even small infants whom the mother keeps trying to breastfeed and the child pushes away the mother because they don't want to breastfeed at that time. So the baby's clue, the baby's giving you a clue here. What the baby needs, read that and then go for it. So even if you're trying to sleep train them into not sleeping with you, the first time that you try these things is with the smaller naps. The smaller naps that the baby takes. Try to see if they're comfortable in the crib. When they get up, do they have that anxious look on their face because they don't see any fun? Do they cry a lot in between? How is the child behaving? And then you can gradually go on to a full sleep at night in a crib. Most of the times, I am very careful when I say that in India, we have not yet evolved to that concept of having a child in a crib in a separate room with a baby monitor on it. We are not there yet.
Yeah.
And I sometimes feel that the anxiety in the parent is so much that I think the parent, one of the parents is going to permanently park near the crib with the next room rather than having a sound sleep. Mm. We're very afraid of missing the clue when the baby cried or had a problem or anything like that. So it's best, even if you want to give the baby a crib, it's best if the baby is right next to your bedside in a crib if you want to. Or see how the baby tells you. If the baby is ready, perhaps by 3 years, it's for sure it's okay to have a separate room. So that's my take on that.
So you talked about trauma in kids. Is it possible for me to traumatize my kids early at like 2 years or 3 years of age?
Oh, you would be surprised to know, Soumya, that even an infant can get traumatized.
Okay.
And the way that it happens is there is a act of commission, that means you're doing something, or there's an act of omission, that means you're just plain neglecting. Right? Mm-hmm. So both these things are examples. So I would say if I do an extreme case, it would be like parents who don't have the time for their child and the child lies in a soiled nappy, crying away, crying. There is a point where the baby is going to get exhausted and go back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in that seat then? There are these neural networks which develop within the brain where the child is learning with trauma that what is it going to take for anybody to notice me. So there is a lot of these, you know, feedback mechanisms that are there in your brain because every experience teaches you. There is a positive reinforcement and there's a negative reinforcement. So when it's a negative reinforcement, like you have parents who are not, don't get along with each other, they're shouting at each other, there's an abusive relationship going on, even an infant absorbs those cues that are being given by the parent. There is a parent who smokes, or the parent who has other issues in terms of drug addictions and things, these things the baby does register. And you will find that such a baby has problems of, mechanisms which allow them to cope later on. Perhaps even stress is higher in them. They are not very conducive to changes in their lives. You will have a problem with their cognition, which means understanding of concepts. Everything gets rewired or haywired, if I may put it, in their brain. So it's not so easy. So trauma is, stress and trauma is a reality from the word go. So what happens is, even if you might have realized this, Soumya, I'm not sure whether you're a colicky baby or not, but if your baby was colicky,
yeah,
and there's this entire anxiety which the family has, oh my God, the child is crying, do something. And if it is a person who is the kind whose anxiety spirals up because of so many, you know, suggestions around them, and they start rocking the baby more violently, you realize that the baby's hysteria goes up. And whereas if there's a person who speaks to the baby with a calm voice, with gentle pats on the stomach, you realize the baby's, the cry pitch comes down, there's a little bit of a hiccup, and then gradually you may be able to make the baby go to sleep even. So you realize that it's the anxiety which affects the child. So there is no such thing that at what age can you traumatize? You could traumatize at any age.
Okay.
That's the bottom line there. But not to say that any kind of discipline or any kind of trigger factor, everything is going to have a negative impact. No, we are talking about sustained negative impact. It's not a single incident which affects them. It will be like a sustained thing that goes on in the family. That's how child will get affected.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah. So going on to a much, not easier, but a different topic. Basically, all the mothers, I think everybody I've met till now is like, my baby doesn't eat. Any solution to that?
Right.
Is that even a problem?
Yeah, well, I agree. And to me, it has been one of the most exasperating questions in my career that my baby doesn't eat. So, so there are a couple of things that you need to understand when you say your baby is not eating. So your baby is not eating, A, because the baby is sick, which is makes sense, right? You don't eat three square meals or three course meals when you're sick. Makes sense there. Second, is your baby not eating because the baby is full already? So we forget that your child is being micro meals are being given throughout the day, every 2 hours. Somebody is putting something in the child's mouth, not allowing the baby to develop the hunger cue at all. And therefore, they're constantly satiated. There is no way that the child is perceiving that hunger feeling at all. That's the second thing. The third thing is, we also need to see whether all these things that you are inferring or assuming, does that actually translate into growth centile curves? Is the child falling off the trajectory? Is the child not having enough stamina? Is the child genuinely not doing very well because of the lack of energy throughout the day? So if those three things are true, then for sure we need to fix it. But at the end of the day, I always go back to my growth charts and I see what the baby is growing. So if the baby is still growing, yet the mother says that the baby is not eating, I usually look for simple things like, what's the quantity of milk that the baby consumes? So a lot of Indian parents especially have this strong belief that when you drink milk only, you grow big and strong. That's a very, you know, founding belief that we all grow up with. And that unfortunately does not work for babies because, you know, I have tried this as an adult as well, that you try, drink a glass of milk in the morning, see at what time you get hungry. You can go better part of the day without a meal because milk is very, very tough to digest for the stomach. So the first 6 months of their life, that's all that they need. But beyond that, when they are going on to the solids, it's a very important thing that we switch that as well and not give them the same amount of milk. That, okay, the child is not eating lunch, let's just give them another bottle of milk. 250 ml gone there. And then the child is absolutely happy all the way to the evening. The baby looks chubby and the baby looks healthy. But do these calories actually translate into good nutrition? Perhaps not, because where will you get your vitamins and minerals from? Milk is good for calcium and protein. What about the rest of it? So that is why it's a very bad. So look at the diet, what you're giving. Look what are the micro meals that are going into the baby and then take a decision that, yes, is there a problem? The second thing is, harder thing to do is let the baby feel hungry. You know, it's a huge thing to ask a mother to, it's either this meal or nothing at all. You know, that is a tough thing to send to the baby and the family. But it works. It works. So there will be like a tantrum thrown out 1 hour later, 2 hours later. And if everybody sticks to their guns, either the baby comes back or then the baby learns that the next time I throw a tantrum, nobody's giving me any other option. Mm-hmm. So that can be perhaps reinforced once the baby crosses the 1 year mark.
Okay.
Not before that. Mm-hmm. Before that, they are unable to express whatever it is. So look at all these factors when we decide this. And also, of course, this entire, you know, thing that goes on that when they are, you know, how much ever chubby I demonstrate them that they are, how much ever is the, you know, weight centile at the heights, and a parent is never happy. They're always, oh my God, he looks so cute. Oh my God. And you've got the opposite end of the undernutrition factor, which is going on now, especially post-pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is hitting the 95th centile and the 100th centile, and I have to tell them, please stop feeding your kids. So it's that scenario as well that happens very commonly. So yeah, I mean, you know, it's so I don't know whether that answers your question, but look at it objectively and perhaps take the cue from your pediatrician to say that, is this actually relating to poor health?
Right.
If it translates to that, sure, we have to do something.
Mm.
But if it is not, then don't. It's just you're fussing over nothing. So yeah.
It could be like when you have two babies and one baby has a very good appetite and your second baby has decided not to eat as much.
Yeah.
And then what do you do? Do you worry? And the second baby is actually growing. Okay, not growing reaching the milestones, but not great as when as a first baby.
Just understanding that we...
Just understand genetics.
They're just different.
Yeah. You have a mother and a father, you know, have the two babies and they both decide to do something else altogether. So it's fine for them to behave completely different. Now, if I have parents who come with both charts, see, this is my older one at 1 year. And see, this is my younger one at 1 year. Look at the difference. They said, yeah, but, you know, it's happened... Both of you can't be a piece of, you know, amazement when you were small at that age. So, yeah.
I know. Soumya has now officially entered the terrible twos.
Any
advice for her?
Oh, no, but I
kind of... I think
we were talking about tantrums, right?
Yeah.
So, my daughter has a temper. She, like, if you don't listen to her, it's very difficult. Like, she'll start throwing things and she'll, like, cry on top of her voice.
Has she turned blue yet?
No, not yet. She'll sit on the floor and then put her head between her legs, which is, like, a very weird position, like a yoga position. I don't think I can ever repeat that, but that's the maximum she's done till now.
Oh, right.
No, terrible twos is an absolutely correct concept because it's one of those times where... The child is now a part of the family, right? Mm-hmm. So now they are understanding what their place is. And now they're trying to sort of elbow their place in. So they're trying to see, what is it I have to do to make them do what I want? So they try everything. And this is also another thing that affects this entire thing is the lack of speech and communication. They're just learning to speak. And so they're not able to sort of express their anger on why they want it, or they're not ready to decide why they should not get it as well. So both of these things is a challenge. So I always say, empower them with speech. So tell them what is what they're looking for. They said, yes, I want that. So then you say, no, you can't have that. And why you can't have that? He says, this is sharp, this is this, this is that. You tell them in their own way. And then you need to demonstrate what happens if they do it. It's one of those things. Second is, it's all right for your mom to explain as well, but just in a firm, calm voice, say, no, you can't have it. Next thing you know, the child is rolling on the floor, banging the head, you know, or perhaps even being beating the parent. That too happens. Again, a firm voice which says no. And sometimes I encourage when the child is having a royal tantrum to even walk away from there, because the moment they realize there is no audience, they stop doing it.
Okay.
So they just look up and say, oh, okay. And then they go behind whoever is it, is the mother or the father, and say, oh my God, please love me, kind of thing. So that's a typical thing that a child seeks recognition. So a child seeks love. So yeah, I mean, that's okay. But it's part of their, psychological makeup now to try all these things.
Yeah. Doctor, there's always a cold or a cough going around these days.
Yes, absolutely.
So at what point do we how do we make up a migraine? Should we take the child to the doctor? Do home remedies work? They can't possibly work on infants.
No. So we don't encourage anything in terms of a home remedy less than 1 year, unless you are talking about just giving them a little bit of humidifier or things like that, which is fine. But again, not really known to work. Sometimes some of these kids who have very bad chesty coughs, even when they're an infant, a nice good steam bath like also works. We encourage you to use a lot of nasal drops and perhaps a fever medication if required. If the cold is such that the child is not able to feed, is not able to sleep, is hugely irritated the whole day, you might want to approach the pediatrician after 3 days. Put the nasal drops, give the good steam bath, keep the baby warm, lots of warm liquids, all of these things you try. And then after 3 days, if it's not working, you need to check, because sometimes the colds have a nasty habit of seeping into the ear, and sometimes the poor oral intake also can be because the throat is congested. So we do occasionally prescribe decongestants or antihistamines for babies if they are so much of a problem. But understand this, if they are viral in nature, in 3 to 5 days it clears from the system. But if it is a bacteria, which is also very likely in India, the point of intervention with the doctor would be a 3 days of fever, not reducing at all, or the child seems to be breathless and having a hacking cough. That's a bad sign. So you definitely need to go. A running nose or a common cold, I would still wait. So I wouldn't really rush in for medical help at that point.
How about getting hurt? Like, kids fall down and they get
again hurt. An injury to the head, which has happened from a height, or if there is a break of skin with a lot of gushing of blood, you have done your
temporary measures of applying ice and pressure and still not stopping, for sure go. Head injury, if it's fallen, the child has fallen to my height or with a great momentum, you must go to the doctor to get it checked out. Also, I say when they're walking, learning to walk, there's a lot of head bumps that they get. That's not what I'm talking about. That's normal. In the process of learning to walk, this is going to happen. That's not something that really is worrying, you know, surprisingly, or rather, you know, the nature has made them in such a way that the brain has a lot of buffer of liquid around it. There's a lot of shock absorbing thing, you know, it generally doesn't problematic. It's not a problem. But however, I would say that if there is a injury because of a momentum and a height, I would not take it lightly.
Okay.
I would keep an eye on this kid. Yeah. So, cuts, you mentioned anywhere else a cut is, if it is something that does not starting to bleed, for sure. If the child is not able to move the limb after that, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's not training.
Okay.
Yeah. So, can we just quickly run through the stages of development? Like from right from infancy as a newborn, and then what happens next? What's we have to do? We go to the pediatrician, get a chart, and then record for those milestones.
So every stage of infancy to like a baby to an infant to a child, there are a set of milestones which come broadly into the category of physical, fine motor, gross motor, fine motor. You have the social skills, and you look at your cognition, which is response to the environment. Mm-hmm. So when you look at all these four parameters, at every stage, there is a different milestone to be achieved. For example, the child has to hold up the neck by the time they are 3 to 4 months. The child has to learn to roll over by the time they are 6 to 8 months. So there is always a broad range. So you have a point where the milestone starts, and you have a point at by which the child must absolutely have got it. There are a lot of variations because there are children who skip milestones. I have loads of kids I have seen who skip crawling altogether. They just, from directly on their tummy, they are creeping to straight away standing up. They don't want to do the knee crawling. You know, there are all these kind of variations. It's all right. And there are children who will not learn to clap until they are 1 year old ones. Some, they are supposed to be learning to clap by the time they are 9 months. If it doesn't happen, we say, okay, keep an eye out on that. That's it. So we have a bar graph which tells you that this is when you should achieve, this is when you should not, we should have absolutely achieved. And when if that, it goes beyond that, that's when we flag the red flag. And so sometimes even a month earlier, for example, a child who has learned to walk independently would start anywhere from 10 to 11 months to 20 months. So we have that much of a leeway. So by 20 months, I would not wait till then, but by the 18th month when I'm seeing the child for shorts and the mother says the child is still not walking, I would definitely look a little bit more in detail to see the development of the muscles. Does the child need a physiotherapy? Does the child need any other supplements? Things like that, to see whether there is any intervention to be done. We don't wait till the end point, but somewhere just before it. But all of the parents would have their vaccination books, which has the list of milestones. Broadly, bring it to the point of notice to your pediatrician if you think that the child is not doing this because it's on the checked list. Mostly 90% of the time, unless there are any other risk factors mitigating, generally the pediatrician will say it's fine, we can wait. So, yeah.
Samia, do you have any other doubts, questions?
Excellent.
She's seen a very cool collective.
I registered that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Lakshmi. Thank you, Samia.
Most welcome. Most welcome.
I think listening to you, probably if we knew all this before the baby was born, it would have been really helpful, because it looks like you have to set patterns right from day one. Like if a baby's crying, you know about stuff. There's so much to learn. Like it would really help if a mother was a pediatrician as well.
No, but my belief is always that the baby is the best teacher. Because I always say that whatever anybody says, your baby decides to behave in an absolutely different manner, which makes me happy. So no amount of textbooks can teach you that. So don't worry, you're all fine.
What about the mother? How do we recognize symptoms of postpartum depression? And who do we take the mother to? How does the mother, does she go on her own? How does this?
So there is a postpartum depression scale, and this is usually done by the gynae, but we have often seen mothers breaking down in our chambers as well when they come with a newborn baby because they just feel unable to cope So there are things in postpartum depression is not a single entity, it's an umbrella, right? So you have from postpartum blues to postpartum psychosis. So there are varying grades of issues that may happen anywhere between these two extremes. So the blues are more or less more, most of us have felt. You know, you have a feeling of generally not being able to cope. There is that entire sense of things going out of your hand and you're not a good mother and you're not doing anything right and everything is going wrong, like kind of a feeling. But that sort of is shorter, self-limiting. And once you see your baby or your, you know, somebody comes in from your family to have a chat with you, you're absolutely fine. There are moments of funk that you have in the day, but there are times where you're not able to connect to your baby. You don't care, the baby's crying. You are not being able to register that the baby needs you. That is certainly a worrisome problem. Sometimes the mothers are self-aware of it and they say to the doctor that, I don't want to pick up my baby. Is that abnormal? So those kind of things is when there are these small little flag signs that go up and say, she may need help. And you have a chat with the spouse, you have a chat with the family to make sure that she's always having people around her and that she's not completely the only person who is in charge of the baby. It's a simple thing. You just need to reach out and ask for a friend. Can somebody go and change the diaper of the baby? That's all you have. That's all you need. And everything, when you decide to do it by yourself, you are setting yourself up for a far more challenging time as a mother. So if you have a good family supporting around you, please use that. And that's perhaps my advice to new mothers. But depression and psychosis, these are serious terms, which I hesitate to discuss in this podcast. But usually there is a preceding event. Some of these mothers show these signs even before they deliver. And some of them have long-term illnesses for which they may have been on medication, but they had to go off it because of the pregnancy itself. So the situation worsens after the baby is born. The blues part, most of us feel, and it's okay to tell your doctor that I'm not feeling so good about this. And usually the doctor will tell you it's a temporary phase or what you can do to sort of solve that problem.
So the root cause for all these things, is it like a hormonal thing or is it just because you're overwhelmed with all of this extra work?
Both, actually. The hormones is what makes the entire maternal thing go into an overdrive, right? So you're full of prolactin, you're full of lactational hormones, and you are perhaps you are given a birth naturally and there is you know, you are having physical issues because of it. You may have had a C-section, you had terrible backaches, you're having long endless nights. There is suddenly no time for yourself and there is no time that you are able to even have a decent meal. All these things sort of, you know, add on, and the entire sense of being overwhelmed, like you said, and things going just out of your control and you don't know how to fix it becomes so paramount then. So it's a natural human feeling. And that's another thing that I've noticed from the time that I started to practice to now, 20 years later, I've realized that that entire element of empathy and sympathy to the mother is now more important, because a happy mother always has, you know, rears a happy child. It cannot come from a place of sadness.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lakshmi. And thank you, Soumya. If you are a new mother and have more questions, write to us at editor@thehindu.co.in with the subject line, Women Uninterrupted. Signing off on this episode of Women Uninterrupted, a podcast for difficult and different conversations, brought to you by The Hindu.